Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents You Are Not Your Mother, Releasing Generational Trauma and Shame by Karen C. L. Anderson. Narrated by Alex Picard. Publisher's Note: Neither the author nor the publisher assumes any responsibility for errors, omissions, or contrary interpretations of the subject matter herein. Any perceived slight of any individual or organization is purely unintentional. The author is not a licensed professional. This book details the author's personal experience and opinions. Among other things, it includes the author's reactions and memories. The author acknowledges that others may remember certain situations that she recounts in this book differently than she does. She is aware that others may have experienced some of the situations in the book in a way that is significantly different from the way she portrays them. Foreword. I write the Rethinking Mental Health blog for Psychology Today, and my usual posts average a few thousand views. I did one called I Hate My Mother. I looked at the numbers today. That post has had 531,137 views so far. By contrast, I Hate My Father has only had 80,000 views. The authoritarian literature, which had its heyday in the 1950s, attempted to answer the following question: who were Hitler's followers? Not who was Hitler. That was seen as a separate question. No. Who were his followers, and what did they have in common? One of the findings was that as many German women as German men loved and revered Hitler. Tens of millions of German women were devoted to Hitler. Can you imagine what they were like at home? One of the great secrets kept secret by exactly those whom you would expect to want to keep it secret is just how many parents are cruel. Cruel not as in peevish or irritable or short-tempered, but cruel as in terrifyingly, remorselessly cruel. And their children are not supposed to be affected? And then that child has children, and those children won't be affected? What stops this intergenerational, multi-generational harm? How can a shamed person not just shame her own children? If your mother was harmed in childhood, and she quite naturally and maybe inevitably harmed you, well, now what? Must you play the hand dealt to you, as if you had no say in the matter, no free will, no chance, and no choice? That's the question, isn't it? Shame is one of the primary results of tyrannical parents harming their children. The shamed child of one generation becomes the shaming parent of the next generation. Unless she doesn't. We are in an age of talking about and talking out these matters, and to some extent at least, we are sharing awareness about how not to be cruel parents like our own cruel parents. Karen C. L. Anderson, by telling her story and by sharing her thoughts, is sharing awareness. She is not saying, snap your fingers, this is going to be easy. She is shedding tears on the page about the experiences she had, and shedding more tears about how the consequences of those experiences keep playing themselves out, even though she wished that they wouldn't, even though she knows better. She has suggestions, but that isn't precisely the point. The point is more in the territory of radical self-acceptance, which, actually, is a deeply controversial idea. There is an interesting divide in the Protestant Church as to how one is saved. Some sects believe that you are saved by doing good works. Other sects believe that you are saved by faith alone. There is the same significant divide in the self-help literature. Some writers argue for the necessity of change. Do better. Enter recovery. If you are not the person you want to be, become that person. Others argue that you are perfectly fine as you are. Love your faults, your flaws, your peculiarities, your pratfalls, your moments of involuntary meanness. Radically and unconditionally accept yourself. If you make the same mistake again, well, that's unfortunate, but still be kind to yourself. Love yourself. Have faith in yourself. Affirm yourself. Period. Karen invites you to think about this fault line, the one between change and acceptance. Who knows what the answer is? But this book is a beautiful asking of the question. I am perhaps more in the camp of good works, and Karen is perhaps more in the camp of faith alone. And perhaps we would never find ourselves in the same congregation. But any given Sunday would find us wrestling with the same question. The question? How to be now, given the past? How to be now? How to be now? Authoritarian parents are real. They exist. They exist by the millions. They do real harm. They ought not to be excused because, or if, they have been harmed themselves. But that is its own separate question. This book is intended for someone who has been deeply, negatively affected by her mother. She can choose to love her mother or hate her mother, keep in touch with her mother or keep her distance from her mother. But all of those are separate questions. The main question is, can she bring the sort of self-awareness to her situation that allows her to see what has happened, what she intends to do, and how she intends to be? This book invites you to be aware. You need that awareness as much as a conductor needs a score. Without that score, the orchestra will play poorly and we will not get music. Without awareness, you will repeat your pratfalls, retain your pain, never feel quite right, and, history tells us, harm the next generation. If you are not to be your mother, best open your eyes. This book is a gentle eye-opener. Eric Maisel, PhD. Preface. 2021. I am lying on the bathroom floor. Even though I just threw up, I am not sick. This isn't a stomach bug. It's not food poisoning. It's a purge. A release. A letting go. A vision comes to me as I lie there. Women standing next to each other, stretching into infinity. One woman hands a box to another woman, who takes it with one hand and, without examining its contents, tucks it inside her heart, while simultaneously using her other hand to take it out and hand it to yet another woman, who does the same with someone else, and so on. Each time the box changes hands, it looks a little different. But inside are the same messages. I am not okay. I am unworthy. There is something wrong with me. I am bad. I whisper to them, it's not yours. Farida knew her granddaughter could never understand how shame could grow and morph and swallow someone until she had no choice but to pass it along so that she wasn't forced to bear it alone. She saw the chain of shame passed from one woman to the next so clearly now, saw her place in the cycle so vividly. She was seized to confess, at last, the fear that circled her brain in endless loops, that she would do the same thing to her daughters that Mama had done to her, that she would force them to repeat her life. Etaf Rum, in her New York Times best-selling novel, A Woman Is No Man, with gracious thanks to Etaf Rum for her permission to use this quote. Part 1. A Timeline of Trauma, Disconnection, and Shame. Shame is like laughter and inspiration. It doesn't knock. Stephen King, in his novel, Fairy Tale. They say that children can't remember much before the age of 4, unless the memories are repeatedly retold and strengthened over time. They also say that human memory is faulty, no matter how old you are. Not to mention that if you experienced any sort of trauma in the first few years of your life, you may not consciously remember what happened, but your body does. Your body remembers. 0 to 5. They fight. I wake up. They are screaming and hitting. I am crying. I am too. My hair is sticky. I am sitting in my high chair. I won't eat my cereal. My mother dumps the bowl over my head. I freeze. And then I cry. My hair is sticky. The kitten dies. I am playing with my dolls in a closet in the apartment above the real estate office and beauty parlor. I am alone. I go to kindergarten when I am 4 because my mother needs to work. One time I have to stand in the corner because I was talking too much. I go to the Kanzos after kindergarten so they can take care of me. I find a big white rock outside and carry it to the door to show Mrs. Kanzo. The rock slips out of my fingers and lands on a kitten at my feet. It's dead. I hide in a room between a bed and the wall. She throws up in the parking lot. My mother picks me up from kindergarten in the turquoise Volkswagen Beetle. She opens the driver's side door and throws up. I disappear. They are sick and throwing up. I climb onto the kitchen counter and get myself some cereal. There's a wedding. Even though I get to be the flower girl, I cry so hard my new stepfather has to pick me up and carry me out of the church. Later, I dance at the reception wearing my yellow dress, white tights, and shiny black patent leather Mary Janes. There's a photo that proves it. 5 to 10. What I did. I'm standing at the blackboard in my second grade classroom after school, writing my numbers from 1 to 100. It's my punishment for calling one of my classmates a crybaby. My face feels hot and prickly. There's a pit in my stomach. I can't breathe. I want to disappear. I felt the same way a few days before when my mother made me tell my stepfather, in graphic detail, about what I had done with some neighborhood kids in the woods. It was a you show me yours and I'll show you mine situation that went beyond showing to touching. I can barely get the words out because I am crying so hard. I wanted to disappear then, too. That's why I was, a few days later, trying to offload that experience onto my classmate. I get home from school and stand in front of a mirror. I make my eyes get hard and squinty. I hate you. You're so ugly. I scratch at my face. I am bad. They take pictures of me. My mother and stepfather take me somewhere and we spend the night in a hotel. All I have is my winter nightgown. It is so hot they give me one of my stepfather's t-shirts to sleep in. My mother wants to take a picture of me in the t-shirt. I don't want her to. I hide in the bathroom, but I can't hold the door against them. I run to the bed and hide under the bed covers, but I'm not strong enough. I tear them off. As I run around the room trying to hide, they take pictures of me. They think it's funny. What I want doesn't matter. I am powerless. I can't swallow the lima beans. I'm sitting alone at the dining room table. My mother is in the kitchen and my stepfather is standing in the doorway watching me. On my plate is a pile of cold lima beans congealed with margarine. I ruin dinner because I refuse to eat them. They coax and threaten and laugh and roll their eyes and tell me there are starving children in Africa who would be grateful to have my lima beans. I want to disappear. They lose their patience. Frustrated, my mother gets up to do the dishes. You will sit there until you eat them, my stepfather says. And if you don't eat them now, you'll have them for breakfast. Tears run down my face. I take a forkful, put it in my mouth, chew a couple of times, try to swallow, and gag it back up onto my plate.
"That will be your breakfast tomorrow,"
my stepfather says through clenched teeth. I am a selfish, spoiled brat. She's disgusted.
"The doctor says she's chunky,"
my mother says to my stepfather after a visit to the pediatrician. I perceive her disgust, fear, frustration, and amusement. I disappear. Something is wrong with me. He drives drunk. I am in the passenger seat. My stepfather is driving me home from choir practice. He's drunk. He slams on the brakes and swears. "But they had their blinker on," I say. He mutters under his breath. He pulls into the garage and slowly turns to look at me with a blank face. I disappear. I have a selfish nature. We are visiting my great-grandparents in New Hampshire. They are meeting Billy, my adopted brother, for the first time. My great-grandmother asks us to present our palms to her for her to read. Billy offers his hand with his fingers spread open. I offer mine with my fingers closed together. She takes our hands in hers and says,
"This shows that Billy has a generous nature, and Karen has a selfish nature.
See?" 10 to 15. Too many Fritos.
"It's not my fault,"
I hear my mother say to my grandmother, who is berating her over the phone for me being fat. I disappear. I am sick in the middle of the night from eating too many Fritos. I don't make it to the bathroom. My mother is disgusted and angry. Extra large? We are clothes shopping at Jamar's. I am in the dressing room. My mother tugs and pulls at the top I've put on. It's too small.
"I don't know if they have an extra large," she says, exasperated and embarrassed.
When she asks Mrs. Krafik, who works there, if they have an extra large, she has that look on her face. Sort of smiling, but also sort of cringing. I must not want it. I'm scrambling to finish the extra chores I was given so I could raise the money to go on the sixth grade trip to Washington, D.C. It's the last day to make the payment, and I haven't earned enough. As the minutes and hours tick forward, I am desperate. I beg for more chores.
"Go get my slippers and I'll pay you 10 cents,
my stepfather offers. And it still isn't enough. I am sure I'm not going to Washington, D.C. because I haven't earned it. I haven't worked hard enough. I must not want it enough. I want to disappear. At the last minute, they sigh and say, "Okay, fine. We'll chip in the last dollar." I am a pathetic loser. I eat them all. I'm taking care of the neighbor's cats. Judy and Charlie live across the street. They're cool. They don't have kids. They travel a lot. When I take care of the cats, I can be alone in their quiet house. I find AIDS candies in the kitchen cupboard. They aren't candy. They are an appetite suppressant disguised as candy. I eat them all. The next time I take care of the cats, there are more AIDS. I eat them all. 15 to 20. $49 short. I am standing at the cash register at my after-school job as a cashier at AG Market. I've been taught how to count back change to the customers, but as the line gets longer and longer, I get nervous and start to disappear. I am confused. The next day, I find out from the boss that my register was $49 short, meaning I'd given customers more change than they were actually due. He fires me. My mother is embarrassed. He drops his pants. My first college mixer. There's dancing and drinking. I meet a boy from the football team.
He dances with me. He holds my hand. He asks me to take a walk with him. He drops his pants and tells me to give him a blowjob. I disappear.
He quickly becomes disgusted with me, either because I have no idea what I'm doing or because I won't do it.
I don't know because I disappeared.
He walks away and never speaks to me again. I must be so unhappy. I'm sitting on the floor of the phone booth in my dorm room listening to my mother tell me after a visit home that she can tell I have gained weight.
You must be so unhappy, she says.
I disappear.
I get fired. Again. I am visiting my father and stepmother for the summer in between my sophomore and junior year of college. I get a job cleaning hotel rooms. I hate it. I get fired. I cry because I will have to go back home. My stepmother is furious because I am crying in front of my little sister and brother. She hisses at me. How dare you upset them like this?
I am bad.
I have sex for the first time and get pregnant and he's gay. It's my senior year. I meet Michael, a freshman. He says he's bi. He is tall and slender and wears eyeliner and has hair dyed strawberry blonde. He wears Aramis cologne. We go to clubs, drink, and dance to Wham, Culture Club, and Duran Duran. I wear a leather miniskirt, fishnet stockings, an off-the-shoulder top, and a long string of fake pearls. I take half a tab of LSD. The pearls break and start bouncing on the dance floor in animated slow-motion plumes of light. Michael and I sleep together without sleeping together. Until we do. I go to bed early. My face is to the wall. I feel Michael climb into bed and spoon me. He slides his hands along my body and tells me how good I feel. I hear laughter. It's not Michael in bed with me. It's my roommate's boyfriend. And there's a crowd of people, including Michael, laughing at me.
I disappear.
Michael and I have sex. I wake up the next morning and know I am pregnant. My mother insists I have an abortion. Not that I have plans to the contrary. Less than a month later, I have that abortion. Of all the things I have experienced shame around, having an abortion is not one of them. Michael breaks up with me. I am devastated. My mother rolls her eyes.
Can't you see he's gay?
21 plus. Nothing, nothing, nothing.
I am living with my mother in her condo after graduating from college. I am commuting to New York City for my first job. I have a boyfriend and am madly in love. One evening, he comes over to hang out with me. She comes home. She is drunk. Her face is blank. I start to disappear. He says,
Hi, Miss Blank. Go F yourself, Blank, she replies.
I disappear.
I come to and frantically call him, my fingers shaking as I punch at the buttons on the phone on the wall in the kitchen. He isn't home yet, so I ask his mother to have him call me back. I stand there waiting for him to call me back.
Nothing. 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 But my body knows.
I race upstairs to my mother's room, and she's sitting there in her bra and a slip, a smirk on her face, with the upstairs phone off the hook.
F you,
I say through clenched teeth.
F you,
I scream. I grab my purse and keys and leave. I don't come back. Because I am fat. He breaks up with me the day before New Year's Eve. I am devastated. I am sure it's because I am fat. Grandma bribes me.
My grandmother sends me an article about dieting and weight loss. She says she'll pay me to lose weight. I disappear. He punches me in the face. The guy I am dating. No, we aren't dating. We are meeting up to have sex, but I can't say that. Wants me to give him a blowjob. I try. I gag. He pushes my head down. My teeth get in the way. He punches me in the face. I disappear. Maybe. My father visits. I lament that I don't have a boyfriend. My father says quietly and with what seems like care,
"Maybe if you lost some weight."
I disappear. I am so frightened I can't speak. I traveled to Missouri with my stepfather and his new wife. We are visiting his parents and extended family there. We drive to Branson for a concert. There's a lot of stop-and-go traffic. All of a sudden, he stops the car in the middle of the road, gets out, and unzips his pants. But it's too late. He wet his pants. He is drunk. His new wife slides into the driver's seat and swears because it's all wet with urine. He turns and looks at me in the back seat. His face is blank. When we arrive, I am so frightened I can't talk. I'm 25 years old, for crying out loud. What's wrong with me? I disappear. I won't go to a hotel to have sex, but I will do it in the back seat of his car. I walk into Teddy's nightclub at the Holiday Inn in Danbury, Connecticut, with my mother and meet a guy. He's tall, dark, and handsome. From Brazil. We talk. We dance. He probably buys me a drink. We might kiss. Maybe. He asks me to meet him there again. The next night? Maybe. Whatever. We make a date to meet there again. I show up at the appointed time. He doesn't. I wait. In the lobby. Because it's a date. With him. I'm not available anymore. I'm not there to meet someone else. So I wait. Every time the door opens, I turn expectantly. Finally, there he is. An hour late. He's with some other guys, friends of his. He seems almost surprised to see me. He walks into the bar with his friends and I trail along behind them. We talk. We dance. He probably buys me a drink. We might kiss. Maybe. He says, "Let's go to a hotel." I start to disappear, but not before I say no. Instead, we drive to a deserted parking lot and have sex in the back seat of his car. A cop shows up and knocks on the window. I marry him because he needs a green card. He cheats on me. He hurts me with words. He is disgusted by me. He pretends he's going to stick me with a needle. He takes pilot lessons. I wish for him to crash and die because I'd rather be a grieving widow than to have to do what I know I have to do. I file for divorce. Why can't I make him love me? I never met his family. Or even spoke to them. I don't think they know I exist. Because I have disappeared. I have love to give. I meet another guy at Teddy's. He says he can tell that I have a lot of love to give. He is also tall, dark, and handsome, but so different from the guy I married. For one, he's from India, not Brazil. He's also kind. He's also polite. He introduces me to his mother, who is visiting from India.
"This is my friend, Karen," he says.
Every December, he leaves the country and travels for a month and a half. I spend one New Year's Eve alone. I spend the next one with my ex.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?